Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And I'm welcoming a guest to the neighborhood, someone I'm pretty excited to talk to. A lot of times on this show, we've had a few famous people, but also we've had people who've been very, very close to famous people. Like we've had keyboardist Jeff Labus, who worked a lot with Van Morrison, and Tom Paxton, who is no slouch himself, but also told stories about his being with Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary. So there's been some of that, and now I've got an actual rock journalist. In fact, someone who almost invented what we think of as rock journalism.
Well, they call me the godfather of rock journalism.
They call him the godfather of rock journalism. That person you hear is Mr. Al Aronowitz talking to us by phone about his very long and in a lot of ways illustrious and momentous career as a rock writer and just a person in the rock era. So first of all, welcome, Al. Hi.
Oh, thanks.
You said you were running a fever. You're doing okay?
Yeah, it's about 101.
Oh, well, typical winter kind of fever. But you've
been
okay.
I don't know what it is. But anyway, you know, right now I'm trying to publicize my two books.
Mm-hmm.
They're both self-published, so the media, the major media like the New York Times and New York newspapers and the San Francisco Chronicle and the Washington Post, they're never going to pay attention to a self-published book. So I feel like a mosquito floating down the river, so proud of my erection that I'm hollering, open the drawbridge, open the drawbridge. You know, because I'm very proud of my work, my books.
No,
Bob Dylan and the Beatles, everybody who's read it, don't tell me they like it. They tell me they love it. And now I got this Bobby Dylan book and the movie, Kevin Spacey's movie, although it's a good entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all biopics are fictionalized.
Right.
And then and Bobby's life, the true story of Bobby's life is stranger than fiction.
Well, what's something about Bobby Dylan that people, you know, wouldn't expect, or, well, knowing him, they'd probably expect anything, but what's something that is in your book that people would be surprised at?
Well, in the first place, he lived for most of his very spectacular but very short life. He lived a lie. He didn't know it. You know, he lived a lie.
And the lie was?
The lie was that the person who he thought was his sister was actually his mother, and the person who he thought was his mother was actually his grandmother.
Ew!
You know, because his mother, his sister had really, you know, had some sex in the gutter and came out with Bobby. And she would never say, she would never tell who her father was.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she just died, the secret died with her.
Now, here's the thing, what people should understand is that you're not just writing from retrospect about Bobby Dylan. You met him, right? You knew him.
The title of the book is Bobby Dylan was a friend of mine. We were good friends. In his last few months of his life, he called me up and said, it's memoir writing time. In other words, he knew he was going to die. He wanted to get together tape by tape his story. He wanted to be the writer's autobiography.
Well, do you have any personal anecdotes that you witnessed?
Well, I have a lot of stuff I wrote about Bobby during the time I knew him because, you know, he was always a very spectacular character and he was always a very interesting character, so I'd always be writing pieces about him, many of which was never published because editors are stupid.
Okay. Well, let's take it back. Let's go back to your origins as, I guess we could say, a Jewish kid in a non-Jewish town. What was it like growing up and being what you must have felt sort of different?
Well, no, I started out as a police reporter in Newark.
Oh, well, Newark, okay.
In Newark, New Jersey, I was a police reporter before that. I was on a state staff. The Newark News was the New Jersey's New York Times.
Uh-huh.
But it went out of business. And I used to help a friend of mine cover the Miss America pageant. And that's how I met Marilyn Monroe, because she was a grand marshal. We took a picture together, me and Marilyn and my friend Joe Grossman. He's looking down at cleavage, and I'm looking at my notes. That's what tells what kind of schmuck I was.
Here's Marilyn Monroe right next to you, and you're looking at your notes, right?
Yeah.
But do you have any other memories of that moment? I mean, did you talk? What?
Because Joe got around to say, well, what do you have on at night? She says, the radio.
Cute.
Very cute.
Okay, man, you never ran into her again, though.
No.
That was your only meeting with her, because there were other people that you were...
I was just a cub reporter.
Okay. And other folks that you cub reported on before you sort of got into the whole rock thing and real famous...
Well, I became a star feature writer on the New York Post. I did Frank Sinatra, I did Bridget Bardot, I did Elizabeth Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
I did, you know, all the stars. Steve Allen,
oh.
The Gore Sisters...
Do you have any particular...
I did a little series, you know, a 6-part, 12-part series. That was a magazine page. And then I also did one on Bobby Darin. We became fast friends.
Okay. What is the name of your book about Bobby Darin, by the way?
It's called Bobby Darin Was a Friend of Mine.
Bobby Darin, I'm sorry, right. But you said that. And where can people get it, first of all?
Well, you got to go into the bookstore, get down on your knees, and beg them to order it.
And
it's a self-published book.
Well, if it's self-published, people can get it from you, can't they?
They can get it from my website, they can get it from the Amazon website, they can get it from Barnes & Noble website.
Oh, okay.
They can get it from Books A Million website. But they've got to get into the stores, and... You know, you got to go into the bookstore and say, please get it, order it for me.
Okay.
I mean,
now,
I'm getting tremendous feedback. I mean, the word of mouth is just great. Like I say, people don't say they like the book, they say they love the book. This is a Bob Dylan and the Beatles book.
Yeah, what is the exact title of the Bob Dylan and the Beatles
book? Bob Dylan and the Beatles.
Oh, okay.
And I introduced Bob to the Beatles, and I introduced them to marijuana.
All right, now let's tell this story. I mean, people will want, even if they hear it now, they'll want to read about this. How did you know Bob Dylan?
Well, I was assigned to do a piece about him for the Saturday Evening Post. I was working for the Saturday Evening Post at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a piece about Paul Newman. I was in the middle of researching a Paul Newman piece, but you know, Paul Newman just, after I met Bob Dylan, Paul Newman became... He wasn't interesting to me anymore. Bob Dylan was the most interesting person I'd met until then.
But Dylan was notably wary and scornful at a certain point of journalists. How did you become part of his email?
Well, he stayed over my house. I don't know if he had an affair with my wife. I don't know.
You think he had an affair?
I did not know.
But I
asked her once, why are all these big shots hanging out with me? She said, because you're a great writer. But, you know... It was a great piece.
But seriously, folks, but what were the years that you were close with Dylan? So it would have been like 64...
In 1963, I met him.
Yeah.
And then we just hung out because, you know, like Jimmy Cannon was a great columnist. I don't know if you remember Jimmy Cannon.
I've heard of him. He was a great stylist. Mm-hmm.
And he was a friend of Frank Sinatra. So people asked him, how come he never wrote about Frank Sinatra? And he said, because I'd rather be his friend.
Hmm.
In other words, once you write about them, they're not going to be your friend anymore. That's the way I felt about Dylan.
So, when he was your friend, do you have any particular memories of incidents or things he said or things that you did together?
Oh, yeah, I got a lot of them. They're all in the book.
I know they're... Well, tell one or two, you know, to whet people's appetite for the book.
Well, he had broken up with his girlfriend, Susie Rotolo.
Uh-huh, yes.
And I take him to New York, and then I take him home back to my house in Berkeley Heights. And he made a stop, and he came out back and told me he had peeked on his knees and peeked through a keyhole. But he was dead in a song, peeking through a keyhole.
Uh-huh, okay.
And then when he got
home... Through a keyhole down upon her knees from Love Mine Is Zero, No Limit.
I don't remember all of Bob's songs. I'm not, you know, I'm really not a Dylanologist.
Okay. Well, you were very close with him. I mean, you thought he was like the be-all and the end-all.
That's
for...
That's right. I thought it was God. I thought it was the new Messiah. You know, and now he goes and gets on TV and puts on Ed Bradley for 30 minutes and says, I'm not a prophet. I'm not a spokesperson.
Well, he was saying that 30 years ago. I mean, he was always saying that.
But, you know, He always put reporters on, you know, like his wife and Joan Baez in the movie Ronaldo and Claire, which was a great whole movie, hours long. And she asked him, did he ever give you a straight answer? And Joan Baez says, no. Did he ever give you a straight answer? And his wife, Sarah Lowndes, says, no. They never give anybody a straight answer.
Hmm.
You know?
But there was a charm. I heard, well, he wasn't being a jerk. He was charming.
He was the most charming guy I ever met. He could charm the venom out of a snake, but he could be a snake too, see.
Do you have any bad memories or bad stories of him? Because obviously you're not close now the way you were.
Well, I don't like the way I was in the Lone Star in New York, hanging out with Rick Danko and Levon Helm, they were friends of mine from the band.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows up. I was a very beautiful young woman, too young for me, really.
Okay.
And
if you have her phone number, I'll take that after the show. Yeah, sorry.
Don't even remember her name. It turned out she was Dr. Ed's daughter. So Dr. Ed was the house in which Dylan stayed when he was cleaning up after his motorcycle accident. which was really not much of an accident at all. He made up all kinds of stories about it. It might have been a snow on the driveway. I don't really know.
Yeah.
It was an excuse to get him. He had some kind of contract with Albert, which he was taking too much dope, and he had to go clean up at Dr. Red's house. So he stayed at Dr. Red's house for a while to detox.
Well, dope. We can't really avoid that topic. First of all, you seem rather proud, and maybe you should be, that you were not only the one who kind of brought Bob Dylan and the Beatles to kind of meet together and just hang out a little bit.
Well, I thought it was a great meeting. I thought what was going to happen did happen. What has happened? The world has great music because of it. The Beatles started writing great lyrics, and Dylan started invented folk rock.
Well, yeah, but there was also the added element of you were giving them, you got them all stoned.
Yeah, well, Dylan was getting stoned on, he didn't need me to get him.
And the Beatles were pretty much clean. I'm sure
they were
all drunks.
I thought, I couldn't believe that anybody who made such beautiful music as the Beatles didn't know about marijuana. And they were singing, I can't hide, I can't hide, I can't hide. I thought they were singing, I get high, I get high, I get high.
But did you feel guilty in retrospect that on some level, yes, you changed the level of music and you on some level affected the fact that we have Sgt. Pepper, that we have Blonde on Blonde, that we have...
I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of. I'm proud of that.
Well, but you, in a way, you may have also caused, like, what happened to Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin. People...
Well, Jimi Hendrix had his own dope thing. I never, I was friends with Jimi.
You knew Jimi Hendrix, too.
Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And, I've always been friends with black people because I love black people. Now I'm a friend of Amiri Baraka, who's a black activist, one of America's greatest living poets. I've known him for 40, 50 years.
Okay.
We've been friends.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that. My question was really about the fact that drugs became so popular, and to an extent, I think it was because the Beatles and Dylan and the Stones made it
cool. Well, you can't
blame
it on Beatles and Dylan, because these guys... Everybody was smoking pot and trying all kinds of recreational drugs. And they were trying, heroin, too.
Right. Well, I have one question about Dylan and drugs, and it's never been answered properly for me, so I really want to know about this. When we all know, of course, during the whole Blonde on Blonde years, that he was stoned pretty much all the time, and doing speed or whatever else. Was he, around the time after the Rolling Thunder tour, but before the Christian gospel stuff, was there a point when he was really wrecking himself? Because his voice, that's when his voice changed.
I wasn't his friend at that time, so I don't really know,
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that when I first met him, he told me he was a junkie, and I didn't believe him. I didn't believe him because he just didn't seem like a junkie.
Well, you first met him in 63, so
yeah.
He wouldn't have been then.
Well, who knows, because he's always fooling around with junk.
Hmm. And you had mentioned in another interview that the Rolling Stones, not just Keith, but Mick, too,
I just finished the first draft of another book called Mick and Miles. It's about the time I took Mick Jagger up to meet Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns into a hilarious mystery.
Why, what happened?
And it starts out with me and Mick in the Hotel St. Regis, in his room in the Hotel St. Regis. I used to score heroin for him. And we're just snorting heroin. And that's how the story starts out.
By the way, you are clean now.
What?
Well, I just want to make sure everybody realizes that you're clean. You've been clean for how long?
Well, it's in the mid-19... I was smoking cocaine, I was smoking marijuana, I was smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
In the mid-1980s, I finally realized that smoke is anti-life. Smoke should never enter human lungs. Not smoke from a burning mattress, not smoke from a marijuana joint, not smoke from a cigarette, not smoke from the exhaust pipe of a car, not smoke from a smokestack, from factory smokes. No smoke or pollutant should ever enter human lungs, because smoke is anti-life.
Did you ever
hear that? I abide by that, and I've lived my life since then that way, But I'm 76 right now, and I'm getting close to the end.
Wow. Yeah, but considering the way you lived your life for about 20 years, it's amazing that you made it to 76 and beyond.
Well, I agree.
What?
I agree. I'm amazed that you've probably lived this long. Hey, if I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. That's an old thing.
Hey, by the way, I was going to mention when you were doing the anti-smoking rap, there's a song on the Allen Ginsberg collection First Blues called Don't Smoke, Don't Smoke, and that's really cool. And it reminded me, the way these synapse brain things work, that you also knew the Beats. I mean, you knew Ginsberg and Kerouac.
Yeah, well, you know, that was my first job of the Post. Wanted me to do. Jimmy Wexler was the editor of the New York Post, and his son liked Ginsberg's poetry. And Jimmy was calling himself an unreconstructed radical, and he wanted his son to be the same way. So they wanted me to go out and do a hatchet job on the Beat Generation. And I read the book, I read On the Road, and it changed my life. Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg changed my life.
Wow.
I mean, you know, the doors, my first time I smoked marijuana was in San Francisco. Michael McClure and an artist named, I can't remember his name. There were two other people. And I was a pretty nerdy middle-class reporter, and they wanted to get me high and see how it would change me. And it did change me. I mean, the first time I smoked marijuana, all of a sudden everything became clear. And I said to myself, this is illegal? That's silly. And I started to laugh. And I started to laugh, and I just rolled on the floor laughing. I rolled on the bed, and I rolled on the floor. I was just laughing. I was laughing the whole time. Just the only time, other time was when we turned the Beatles on, and at that time we had a big laugh.
In fact, John Lennon referred to it from then on for a period. Whenever he wanted to get high or have the other Beatles get high with him, what would he say?
He said, let's have a laugh.
Let's have a laugh.
Yeah, or else he said, let's do an hour on it.
You really? So you became synonymous in the Beatles' minds with, like...
Yeah. Hi, this is Al Aronowitz, and you're listening to Days Gone By on WGBB.
Okay.
And, you know, and then Derek Taylor died of cancer, throat cancer, and George, and I love George.
Yeah, you sort of knew him even up till kind of the end. It's not like you just knew him in the 60s. What was George like away from the Beatles?
He was like a saint.
Really?
He was the only saintly superstar I ever knew. I mean, money changes everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, money and power changes everybody. They all get changed. Like James Taylor, I introduced him to Miles Davis. I'm trying to get a hold of him to see if he remembers at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get back to me. I don't have access anymore. I mean, everybody's got a big shot with his nose up in the air.
Well, maybe you also alienated people from the way you were behaving for 15, 20 years. I mean, if you were just asking people for money for drugs.
I don't know these people.
Okay, cool. I mean, I think I read in one of the interviews that you still, quote-unquote, owe Paul Simon some money or something like that.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, but, I mean, he'll never... What did you want that money for? It was probably not anything particularly good.
I was managing acts.
Oh, were you? What bands were you managing?
I managed an act in partnership with Carol King and Jerry Coffin.
Oh.
That was my, then I was the first manager of the Velvet Underground. And
whoa. What, you were the first manager of the Velvet Underground?
Yeah, I took him out of the fifth floor walk-up and put him into the Cafe Bazaar. I brought Nico in to see him. Nico wanted a band. She told, Andy Warhol. But I was the invisible man. I didn't count. Everybody just saw right through me. They didn't think I was there. So Andy just stole the band because... The Velvet Underground was just a bunch of hustlers anyway. They were junkies.
They were even junkies from the get-go. And do you have, I guess everybody has a bad Lou Reed story, but do you have a bad Lou Reed story?
Well, yeah, one time I sent him a letter and he sent it back to me unopened.
Well, that's nice. Maybe he was so paranoid. Yeah. And what about the other folks, like Cale and, I know you didn't think Nico had much talent. But.
No, I didn't. She was like an undertaker. She was so morose.
Talk about heroin chic. I mean, that's the definition.
She got very deep into heroin. She even had a little son that she got him hooked on heroin.
Who are other people that you really liked or still like? I mean, you say obviously very nice things about George Harrison. Who else are the good souls that you came across?
Well, I just can't remember them offhand.
Okay.
I mean, I always liked Miles Davis. Miles Davis was a black friend. Miles was very anti-white. But he had me. You know, I had my column. I was the hottest column in town at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was acting like his press agent. And then they had his stockbroker was white, and his lawyer was white. You know, he knew his way around.
Well, sure. I mean, let me ask you something, though. Here you were sort of in Cameron Crowville of your time. You were kind of the hottest rock reporter, and really, I think, even before Chris Gow and Lester Bangs and stuff. So you had that column. How did it fall apart, in a sense? Why?
Well, the executive editor of this, the New York Post, I don't know, he may have had a relationship with my wife that I didn't know about.
Okay. God, your wife, she got around.
Yeah, she was quite a woman.
Okay.
And I loved her very much.
She loved a lot of people very much. No, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, you know, the happiest time in a man's life is when he's raising a family. And we had three kids. That was the happiest time of my life.
Okay.
Raising a family with her.
All right. But again, so you fell out with the editors of the Post, surprise.
Well, you know, they thought I was a schmuck. That's because when one of the editors told me he was going to bet $1.50 on a horse, I thought he meant $1.50.
And he meant,
very innocent, very naive. And they treated me that way. They treated me like I was a schmuck, and I was a schmuck. He couldn't stand it when I'm writing this column, and everybody in town is talking about this column, and it's the most popular column in town. And mm-hmm. he was trying to bury it in the back of the paper in the entertainment section with all the entertainment heads. He'd never put it up front. It was, you know, and he never tried to syndicate it. And he hated me. You know, he was jealous. When my wife died, I hooked up with Paul Krasner's ex-wife.
Oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. You hooked up with
my wife died, I hooked up with Paul Krasner's ex-wife.
Okay.
She was quite a number.
Okay.
And
so... And then, obviously, you had the very bad drug years. You came out of them and started putting your stuff together for a book and also on as a web journal. A lot of it is available on your website.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fan got so jealous. He got green with envy and purple with rage that I was a younger, sexier woman.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't stand it. He really couldn't stand it. So he tried to get me to resign. He tried all kinds of tricks, and finally he fired me. It's against the rule of the union contract to fire me. He couldn't fire me,
mm-hmm.
but he did. He said he had the union in his pocket, and he did have the union in his pocket. The American Newspaper Guild is a lame excuse for a labor union. The first day of my arbitration, the union lawyer takes me for a walk and says that mine is a conflict of interest case, which it was not, and they can't win a conflict of interest case because they just won one.
Huh.
So they're gonna throw my case. And he says, I never took it. I swear on a stack of Bibles, I never had this conversation with you. Just like a lawyer.
You then went through a pretty bad, rough period.
Yeah, I went through a very bad, rough period. I began, I was into drugs. I was dealing drugs. I was dealing cocaine.
How did you stay out of jail?
What?
How did you stay out of jail?
Well, I managed to stay out of jail, but I was busted one time.
Hmm.
And I got a good lawyer, and he got me off.
Okay, very good lawyer, all things considered.
Yeah.
And then you said no more smoke, and you pulled out of it, and then you decided.
No, I mean at that time I was not a cocaine dealer, but after they accused me of having, I had 3/4 of a gram of cocaine in my pocket,
mm-hmm.
and this Maryland state trooper wanted to turn it into a big bust. He said I had 12 grams. That made me a coke dealer, and I didn't have 12 grams. Not 3/4 of a gram. I didn't do very much cocaine in those days at all. And then they sent me, I had to do a piss test. And
right.
Then I moved up to Albert Grossman's place in Norfolk County, and they didn't have any facilities to give piss tests.
Right.
So I became a cocaine dealer.
In their eyes? Or did you really?
In my eyes.
Oh.
I used to walk around with $1,000 in my pocket, but I'd smoke it all up.
Did
I
you ever
remember
feel...
reminiscence once about, and it's coming out in the next book. The book is called For Adults Only, and there's a reminiscence about how I met my first coke whore.
Do you ever feel guilty about, doing that?
No.
I mean, selling dope to people?
No, I never felt guilty.
I mean, even cocaine. I mean, cocaine can destroy people. It destroyed yours.
Yeah, it made me crazy, you know. And when I thought I was hip to be smoking cocaine, and I was writing stuff, and I read what I'm writing, and it's not hip at all. It's crazy. Mm. So that's why I quit.
Because you saw what it was doing.
I quit because I wanted to quit out of sheer willpower. I didn't need a shrink. I didn't need a rehab. I didn't need Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't need anybody. I just quit all by myself.
Well, good. And then the problem was when you finally cleaned up and came out of it, suddenly the people weren't taking it.
I was crazy. I mean, I was really crazy for a long, long time. From 1972 until the mid-80s, until finally I discovered the Internet.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, this is a way to do it, and then run around these stupid editors' blacklist. Because I consider editors deaf, dumb, blind, ignorant, and arrogant. All I bring to a manuscript is arrogance.
Yeah.
I can't deal with editors, because in me they see their own arrogance reflected.
Hmm.
So I had to self-publish my book.
You have the two books that are self-published, the Bobby Darin and Me, and Dylan Meets the Beatles.
And another one is in production. That's called For Adults Only. That has my reminiscence about how I met my first co-core. Very funny story.
Now, are there any musicians?
There's another book in production that's called Retro Pop Scene, Backstage at the Rock Revolution.
Oh, okay. So what kind of stories are in that one?
21 stories about different stars.
Like?
Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Dylan, The Gaslight Cafe.
Oh, wow. Okay. Are there any musicians that you listen to today? Any bands that really, obviously they're not Dylan, they're not God. But what do you listen to these days?
I listen to news.
Okay. Isn't that rather evanescent?
Well, I'm a newspaper man. I've always been a news junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And I listen to old tapes. I used to record singles that I liked and make a tape of them. And I play that when I'm writing sometimes.
Okay.
I listen to Miles Davis in a silent way and Kind of Blue. I mean, Miles is so inspiring to me.
Okay.
He's one of the greatest.
Well, what do you hope to accomplish in, as you said, you're 76 years old. You may not have a whole heck of a lot more time. You're
I'm
not in the best
trying to get
health.
These books out. I mean, so pretty soon I'll have four books out.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty soon I'll have five books out. And then I got a few more books I can beat Papers of Al Aronowitz.
Sounds good.
Young Jane Fonda. Moon Jasmine at Home with Jerry Garcia.
Oh, gosh. Any good Jerry stories?
What about the time your brother chopped your finger off? And it was like, he didn't want to say anything about that because he kept that a deep, dark secret.
Well, how did his brother accidentally cut the tip of his finger off? How did that happen? Do you know?
And they were out camping. I forget how the story goes.
And, of course, Garcia turned that into the deficit into a plus by learning how to pick in his special guitar way.
His father was named him after Jerome Kern.
Cool.
And his father was a musician. And he saw his father get swept away while fly fishing in a stream.
You mean his father drowned? That's
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. But do you personally, any stories that you and he, when you were hanging out or you know, something that might surprise us about Jerry Garcia?
Well, what surprised me was that he was a junkie. You know, I know.
That surprised you?
Yeah, it surprised me. I didn't know he was a junkie. I thought he was just into cocaine because we used to do a lot of cocaine together.
Oh, you mean you use the word junkie to refer specifically to heroin use, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he was into that, I guess, for a long, long time. Well, remind people, please, how to get your... Well, I mean, obviously they can go in the bookstore, but the bookstore will not have them. They've got to go
You got to go in there and get down on your knees and beg them to get it. Just beg.
Okay.
Because, like I say, I'm just a mosquito floating down a river. I mean, I'm just nobody. I'm an invisible man.
Well, not if you're on the radio and not if you're on the net.
Well, that's why I'm going on
the
radio.
Books. Yeah.
Get my book promoted this way.
And tell people what is your website, because obviously they should be able to go there and get
your
book.
Well, you just Google my name, Al Aronowitz, or you Google The Blacklisted Journalist, and it'll get you right there. It's a very extensive website.
The Blacklisted Journalist is Al Aronowitz, A-R-O-N-O-W, ITZ. Google him to get his website, because it's really worth seeing, and you'll see a lot of the stuff that he's talking about in chapters from the books, and then you can obviously get the whole books themselves about Bobby Darin and Dylan and the Beatles, and then chapters obviously on Velvet Underground and Hendrix and Joplin and so much more stuff. Al, I want to thank you so much for taking this time out to...
Okay, David, well, thank you for having me on my show.
Maybe one day your show, too. A lot of interesting stuff from Al Aronowitz. I want to thank you again for appearing on Dave's Gone By.
Okay, David.